A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's follow-up arrived this week, and it starts from a place we've already established. The industrial vacuum tier is real. It lasts, and a domestic buyer can actually reach it through the business supply channel. The question now is the practical one. How do you verify you're not buying a consumer unit in a steel costume? What's the smallest machine that still meets the durable standard? How does living in a house with stairs and a hall cupboard change the calculus versus a warehouse floor? Does wet-dry actually cost you more than it's worth? Which professional fittings earn their place at home? And which manufacturers should you actually be looking at given regional availability? So this is a spessing exercise. By the end, the listener should be able to write a shortlist and walk into a supplier with it, not a brand wish list.
The core tension is translation. These machines are designed for a janitorial closet in an office building with a flat floor and a maintenance budget. A house has stairs, a hall cupboard, and one person who has to carry the thing up two flights. So the entire buying problem is translating commercial intent into domestic reality.
And the order you resolve the variables matters. Durability verification first, because if you get that wrong, nothing else matters. Then physical size, because that constrains everything downstream. Then wet-dry, because that's where most home buyers make an expensive mistake. Then accessories, because that's the final filter.
Let's start with the verification checklist, because the industrial styling problem is real. Chrome trim, aggressive lines, a big number on the side, none of that tells you anything. The motor type is the first real signal. A bypass motor cools itself independently of the airflow. The air that carries dust and water never passes over the motor windings. A through-flow motor routes the working air over the motor to cool it, which is fine for dry consumer use and fatal the moment that air is wet or blocked with fine dust.
So the bypass motor is the difference between a machine that survives wet pickup and a machine that dies the first time you vacuum up a spilled mop bucket.
That's the mechanism. And it's the first thing to check on a spec sheet. If the manufacturer doesn't say bypass motor, assume through-flow. The second check is duty rating. Consumer machines are rated for intermittent use, 20 minutes on, 20 minutes off, something like that. A commercial machine will have a continuous duty rating, meaning it can run 8 hours a day without overheating. That's not a marketing claim, it's an engineering specification, and it's the single most meaningful number on the sheet.
More meaningful than wattage.
Wattage is nearly meaningless across tiers. Consumer marketing inflates peak suction figures and wattage numbers because that's what sells. A machine that draws 2,000 watts and overheats after 20 minutes is worse for longevity than a machine that draws 900 watts and runs all day. The duty rating and the filter class are the numbers that predict a 15-year service life.
Filter class being the M&H dust ratings.
Class M traps 99.9% of dust down to a certain particle size. Class H goes further, and these matter if you're vacuuming fine dust from drywall or woodwork. A consumer HEPA label isn't the same as a certified Class H filter. The certification means the machine was tested as a complete system, not just the filter cartridge in isolation.
So the spec sheet checks are bypass motor, continuous duty, certified filter class. What about standing in front of the machine?
Pick it up. A industrial machine has mass. Heavy gauge steel or thick polypropylene tank, braced handle, substantial wheels. Consumer machines are light because they're built to a price and designed to be carried by one hand. Industrial machines are built to be wheeled, not carried. If you can lift it easily with one hand, it's probably not the other tier.
The heft test.
It's crude, but it works. The housing material is the giveaway. Powder-coated steel or thick polypropylene that doesn't flex when you press it. Thin ABS that cracks at the first impact is consumer territory. And then there's the serviceability test. Can you buy a replacement motor, a replacement switch, a replacement hose for this machine in 5 years? Is there a parts diagram? Is there a parts supplier? Or is it a sealed disposable unit where the manufacturer expects you to throw it away and buy another one?
That's the check most people skip, and it's the one that actually determines total cost.
The seal and bearing construction tells you more than the motor spec. Look for sealed ball bearings on the motor shaft, a gasketed filter chamber, and a float valve that actually shuts off suction before water reaches the motor. Those are the parts that predict a 15-year service life. A machine with a cheap sleeve bearing and a filter that doesn't seat properly will wear itself out no matter how good the motor is.
The float valve point is specific to wet-dry machines. A dry machine doesn't need one.
Correct. And that's a distinction we'll get to. The price signal is worth naming. Genuine commercial-grade machines typically cost 2 to 3 times a comparable consumer unit. But the total cost of ownership flips because the commercial machine is serviceable. You replace a $40 carbon brush set rather than a $200 hole machine. The service interval matters more than the purchase price.
And the carbon brushes are the consumable that tells you the motor was designed to be maintained. A sealed consumer motor doesn't have replaceable brushes because the manufacturer never intended anyone to open it.
And that's the difference between a machine that's designed to be maintained and a machine that's designed to be replaced. The carbon brush is the canary in the coal mine. If the spec sheet lists a replacement interval for brushes, that's a machine the manufacturer expects you to keep. If it doesn't, that's a machine they expect you to throw away.
So the verification checklist is doing two jobs at once. It's filtering out the cosmetic industrial styling, and it's also filtering out the machines that are technically commercial, but not actually serviceable.
Right. There are machines sold through commercial channels that are still disposable in practice. They have the look, they might even have a bypass motor, but if there's no parts diagram and no replacement motor available, it's a consumer machine wearing a work jacket.
The single most reliable in-person test is the one I mentioned. Pick the machine up. But the checklist as a whole is necessary and not sufficient, because the thing that actually bites in a house is the footprint.
And that's where the translation problem really starts. You can verify durability all day, but if the machine doesn't fit in your hall cupboard, you bought a very durable paperweight.
So let's talk size, because this is the core of the episode. What does the professional category actually come in?
4 form factors. The compact canister, roughly 10 to 15 liters, sits on a wheeled base and is house compatible. The backpack unit puts the motor on your back with a hose to the floor tool, solves stairs awkward in a hallway. The mid-range drum, 20 to 30 liters, is the warehouse workhorse, and the 40-plus liter monsters are the point of no return for domestic storage.
So the smallest machine that still meets the durable standard is the compact professional canister.
That's the floor of the genuine tier. 10 to 15 liters, bypass motor, steel, or thick polytank, serviceable parts. Below that, you're back in consumer territory regardless of what the catalog says. There are compact industrial models that demonstrate the tier comes in house-compatible footprints. Kircher makes professional-grade canisters in a footprint close to a domestic unit, and those are the proof that small doesn't automatically mean consumer.
But the compact canister is the only form factor that lives in a house. A 30-liter drum on wheels is fine on a flat concrete floor and miserable up a flight of stairs.
The backpack unit solves stairs, but it needs dedicated storage and it's awkward for general household use. You don't want to strap on a motor to vacuum the living room rug. The compact canister fits in a hall cupboard and can be carried one-handed. That's the translation. The machine's job in a house is to be a stable anchor, not a vehicle.
Say more about that anchor point, because I think it's the thing most people get wrong about domestic vacuuming.
Maneuverability in a home is about the hose and the floor tool, not the machine. A compact canister that stays put while you work the hose around furniture beats a larger machine you have to drag through doorways. The machine sits in the middle of the room, you work around it, and then you move it once. In a warehouse, the machine moves constantly because the floor area is enormous. In a house, the floor area is small enough that the hose does the work.
So the smaller machine isn't a compromise. It's actually the better tool for the space.
In a domestic context, yes. The bigger tank means fewer trips to empty it, but in a house, you're not generating that much debris. A 15-liter tank is plenty for a week of household vacuuming. The 40-liter drum is for a janitor who's cleaning an office building every night.
And there's a psychological thing here, too, isn't there? The bigger machine feels more powerful, more professional, so people gravitate toward it. But the reality is, you're buying capacity you'll never use, and a footprint you'll resent every time you drag it out of the cupboard.
That's the consumer instinct talking. Bigger number, bigger machine must be better. But the professional buyer thinks in terms of fit for purpose. A janitor choosing a machine for a specific building doesn't buy a 40-liter drum for a small office suite. They buy the machine that matches the space. The domestic buyer should do the same thing, but the marketing pushes them toward overspecification.
And overspecification in size is almost as expensive a mistake as overspecification in wet-dry capability.
Which brings us to the wet-dry instinct, because most home buyers want it, and most home buyers shouldn't have it.
Let's dig into that. Why is the wet-dry instinct so strong?
Because it sounds like a free upgrade. The machine can do two things instead of one, and the price difference seems small, so it feels like you're getting more for your money. But the capability isn't free. It's paid for in three separate currencies.
The presumption is that wet-dry is a free capability. It isn't. Choosing wet-dry costs you in three ways. Filtration first. Wet-dry machines typically use a cartridge filter that's worse for fine dry dust than a proper HEPA bag setup. The cartridge has to be washable, which means it's a different material, and it doesn't seal as well against fine particles. So you're compromising the dry vacuuming experience, which is 99% of what you'll actually do, for a capability you'll use twice in a decade.
And that filtration compromise is invisible until you notice the fine dust settling back out of the machine, or you realize the air in the room doesn't feel as clean after vacuuming as it should. It's a slow, subtle degradation, not a dramatic failure.
The second cost is bulk.
The float valve and the drain add height and complexity. A wet-dry machine is taller, heavier, and has more failure points than a dry machine of the same capacity. The third cost is convenience. You're cleaning the tank that's been wet. Water sits in the bottom, you have to drain it, dry it, deal with the smell if you didn't get it all out, and you're doing that for a capability you almost never use.
So the distinction that matters is between a true wet-dry machine and a dry machine with a wet mode.
A true wet-dry machine has a bypass motor and a float valve that shuts off suction before water reaches the motor. A dry machine with a wet mode is a marketing feature. Without the bypass motor and the float valve, wet pickup will kill the motor. The first time you vacuum up a significant amount of water, the water reaches the motor, and that's the end of the machine. It's not a gradual degradation, it's a sudden death.
So if you need wet pickup, buy a true wet-dry. If you mostly vacuum a house, the filtration compromise isn't worth it.
And when would a home user be glad they had it? A flooded basement, a burst pipe, a workshop with coolant spills. Those are real scenarios. But they're rare, and the question is whether you want to compromise your daily vacuuming for a contingency you can handle with a mop and bucket.
The mop is the competitor here. Wet-dry vacuuming is competing with a $5 mop, and the mop wins for most household spills.
The mop wins for most household spills. The wet-dry machine wins for a flooded basement where you're removing gallons. That's the threshold. If you're not removing gallons, you don't need wet pickup.
There's a middle scenario worth naming. What about the person who has a workshop in the garage and a house above it? They're generating sawdust in the workshop and they're vacuuming carpets upstairs. Is that a wet-dry case or a dry case?
That's a dry case with a dust class upgrade. The sawdust is dry, the carpet is dry, and the fine dust from woodwork is exactly what a Class M or Class H filter is for. You don't need wet pickup for sawdust. You need better filtration. The wet-dry instinct gets triggered because workshops feel industrial, but the actual requirement is dry filtration at a higher class.
The workshop buyer should be looking at a dry machine with a certified filter class, not a wet-dry machine with a compromised filter.
Correct. And that's a useful distinction because it separates two things that get conflated. Industrial doesn't mean wet. Industrial means durable and serviceable. Wet is a specific capability for a specific scenario, and it has costs attached.
Once you've decided what the machine is for, the final filter is the accessories.
The professional attachment range assumes floor areas nobody has at home. 30-inch floor tools for corridors, industrial crevice tools for warehouse racks, wall mount kits, tool caddies designed for janitorial carts. None of that earns its place in a house. What earns its place is the standard hose, a good floor tool with a brush that can be switched off for hard floors, a crevice tool, and a dusting brush. That's the domestic set.
The standard hose fitting matters because it's the upgrade bath.
The standard professional hose fitting is 35 millimeters, roughly 1¼ inches. That's the universal standard that makes professional accessories interchangeable across brands. A professional machine with a standard hose fitting accepts any professional accessory, and that's where the domestic buyer gets real value. The machine is the durable anchor, and the accessories are replaceable and upgradable over 15 years. You buy the machine once, and then you can buy a better floor tool 5 years later from a different manufacturer, and it just fits.
That's the opposite of the consumer model, where every brand has its own fitting, and you're locked in.
The consumer model treats the fitting as a lock-in mechanism. The professional model treats it as a standard interface. That's the difference between a disposable product and a durable platform. The fitting is the tell. If a machine has a proprietary fitting, the manufacturer is telling you something about their business model.
The spec is coming together. Bypass motor, continuous duty, steel or thick poly tank, serviceable parts, standard hose fitting, 10 to 15 liters, dry only unless you need wet pickup.
The manufacturers are regional. The previous episode covered who they are, so this is just orientation. The brands you'll actually encounter depend on where you live. In Europe, Kircher and Pneumatic are everywhere. In North America, it's different names. The shortlist spec matters more than the brand name, because the spec is what predicts longevity. A brand you've never heard of that meets the spec is a better buy than a famous brand that doesn't.
The actionable core is to write the spec and walk into a supplier with that, not a brand wish list.
That's the whole episode in a sentence. The verification checklist keeps you out of the consumer tier. The size question keeps you in a machine you'll actually use. The wet-dry analysis saves you from the most expensive mistake, and the accessories are the final filter.
But there's a question that's been sitting under all of this, and it's the one nobody asks until it's too late. How do you check, before buying, whether a manufacturer will still support a machine in 10 years? The parts availability question.
That's the real long-term risk. The spec sheet tells you what the machine is today. It doesn't tell you whether the manufacturer will still be making replacement wheels in a decade, and that's the failure mode nobody prices in.
It's a failure pattern that's almost impossible to predict from the outside. A company can have a great reputation, a long history, and then get acquired or pivot, and the parts dry up.
That's the thing. Parts availability isn't a spec sheet item. It's a supply chain question, and the supply chain can change for reasons that have nothing to do with the quality of the machine.
I worked a summer for a building maintenance contractor in Manchester, mid-90s. The firm's entire cleaning arsenal was a fleet of industrial wet-dry machines, the big 40-liter drums on wheeled bases. They'd been in service since the late 70s and were still running on original motors. The wet-dry debate you two have been having is a luxury. In that job, the machines were wet-dry because they had to be. Nobody thought twice about the filtration compromise because the alternative was a separate machine for floods and a separate machine for dust, and the budget didn't run to that. The twice-in-a-decade capability is exactly what saved that contractor's bacon more than once. A burst pipe in a basement at 6 p.m. on a Friday with no plumber available until Monday. You don't need wet pickup often, but when you need it right then. The machines were eventually retired not because they broke, but because the firm couldn't get replacement wheels. The tanks and motors were fine, the casters had worn out, and the manufacturer had stopped making them. So the whole fleet went to scrap because of a consumable part.
That's the serviceability point made concrete. The machine can outlive its consumable parts, and parts availability is the real longevity variable.
The question becomes how you verify parts availability before buying, not after the wheels have worn out.
You check whether there's a parts diagram available. Whether the manufacturer publishes a parts list, whether there's a supplier who stocks replacement motors and switches and hoses, you can ask the supplier directly. If they can't tell you where to get a replacement motor, that's your answer.
That's harder to verify than any spec sheet, because it's a bet on the manufacturer's continued existence and commitment.
It's a bet, and it's a bet you can improve by looking at the manufacturer's history. Have they been making the same machine for 10 years, or do they refresh the line every 2 years? A manufacturer that keeps a model in production for a decade is more likely to still be supporting it in another decade. a manufacturer that churns through models is signaling that they treat machines as disposable.
That's a useful heuristic. Long production runs mean long parts availability.
It's not a guarantee, but it's a signal, and it's one of the few signals you can actually read before buying. The other one is the parts diagram itself. If the manufacturer publishes an exploded parts diagram with part numbers, that's a machine they expect you to maintain. If they don't, that's a machine they expect you to replace.
The final checklist has a temporal dimension. You're not just checking what the machine is, you're checking what the manufacturer's relationship to the machine will be in 10 years.
That's the thing no spec sheet can fully tell you. But the parts diagram, the production run length, and the supplier's ability to answer the parts question are the best proxies available.
The compact professional canister is the answer for most home buyers, but the category is regional. The brands you'll actually encounter depend on where you live, and the shortlist spec matters more than the brand name.
That's worth repeating because it's the thing people get wrong in the other direction. They find a brand they trust and they buy whatever that brand makes, regardless of whether it meets the spec. But the spec is the thing. A trusted brand can still sell you a consumer machine with industrial styling.
The misconception to correct is that wattage and peak suction figures indicate quality. They don't. Duty rating, filter class, and parts availability are the meaningful numbers.
The spec is the thing. Bypass motor, continuous duty, steel or thick poly tank, serviceable parts, standard hose fitting, 10 to 15 liters, dry only unless you need wet pickup. Walk into a supplier with that, and you'll walk out with a machine that lasts 15 years.
If you walk in with a brand wish list, you'll walk out with whatever that brand wants to sell you.
That's the difference between buying as a professional and buying as a consumer. The professional writes the spec first and treats the brand as a secondary consideration. The consumer picks the brand first and hopes the spec follows.
The open question is whether manufacturers will still be supporting these machines in a decade, and that's the one thing no spec sheet can tell you.
But the parts diagram, the production run, and the supplier's answer to the parts question are the best signals you can read before you commit.
That's where we'll leave it. The spec is the thing, the parts question is the risk, and the Combat Callister is the answer for most people listening.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.